and certainly their first time in Ethiopia. A region near Harar had been chosen as a prime opportunity to see how specialty coffee was grown, harvested, and processed on a large scale. From Addis Ababa, the drive to Harar was 8 hours and cut through countless small towns. The views were magnificent. Ethiopia was green. Everything along the way was green. Ethiopia, like Yemen, was a country plagued by misperceptions from the rest of the world. When the West thought of Ethiopia, they thought of poverty and famine, emaciated babies dying in the desert. But the Ethiopia Mokhtar saw was a bustling East African nation of cities and farms and lakes, with a large and educated middle class, a feisty press, and, in Addis Ababa, a capital city that rivaled Nairobi and Johannesburg. But they were not staying in Addis. They were passing through, on their way to Harar, the birthplace of coffee. It was in the hills of Harar that the mythical shepherd, Kaldi, had first noticed a sleepless spring in the steps of his goats, and had sampled the coffee cherries he'd seen them eating. There was still coffee grown in this region of Ethiopia, the Yirga Chefe, in vast hillside farms blessed by ample seasonal rain. Harar, though, was something unique. An ancient city, home to some of the country's oldest mosques, a city almost untouched by modern architecture. In all of Ethiopia, it was the most Yemeni city, a place where Arab traders had been coming for 1,000 years and where they still exerted great cultural influence. Harar was also the adopted home of Arthur Rimbaud, the young French poet who became a central influence for the surrealists, exiled himself in a ramshackle home high above the city. A drug addict and sometime gun runner, he was also, for a short period, a coffee trader. He died in France in 1891 at the age of 37, while planning his return to Africa. The Ethiopian way of making specialty coffee was a revelation. Now the methods and standards Mokhtar had been preaching to the Yemeni farmers could be seen in practice. If they hadn't believed him before, when he showed them pictures of vast drying beds full of bright red cherries, now they saw it for themselves. It could be done. And done without vast sums of money or advanced technology. The Ethiopians picked cherries the same way the Yemenis did, by hand, but with greater care, and they used more precise methods all along the chain of production. The only facet of Ethiopian production that had no bearing on Yemeni growers was the use of wet processing. The Ethiopians were using vast amounts of water to wash their beans. Typically, the coffee farms were located near rivers, and the Ethiopians were diverting river water to clean their coffee, and then allowing the runoff to re-enter the water system. But the runoff was not potable, and because the water was now mixed with sugars from coffee plants, it altered the chemistry of any river or stream or water table it entered. In a world concerned with water usage and the dwindling access to fresh water, and the rising cost of fresh water, using so much of it in coffee processing wasn't, it seemed, politically or financially tenable in the long term. Some Ethiopian coffee farmers were already experimenting with dry processing. In Yemen, Mokhtar knew they had no choice. Producers there knew no other way, and would rarely have access to the volumes of water necessary for wet processing. Dry processing had been the only way of Yemeni coffee since the beginning. It was both the strength of Yemeni beans and their weakness. Traditional dry processing had the potential to capture unusual flavors and could bring out the wildest and boldest parts of a bean. But dry processing, if done without great care, led to quality so inconsistent that the coffee was commodity grade at best. In Ethiopia, Mokhtar saw vast above-ground drying beds filled with ruby-red cherries. He saw small farms with their own varietal labels, farms sending their coffee directly to roasters in Europe and Japan. He saw the effects of direct trade, where the roasters told the farmers what they needed, and the farmers knew how to accommodate those needs. It was a beautiful symbiosis, without layers of brokers and loan sharks that invariably sapped the producers of profit. Mokhtar flew back to Yemen, wanting to share what he'd seen with Yusuf and the Alamal Cooperative. He tried calling them for days and got no answer. Finally, Yusuf picked up.
"I'm sorry," he said. "We had a death in the village."
"Who was it?"
Mukhtar asked.
It was Malik, Yusuf said. He died the night you left.
Mukhtar couldn't make sense of it.
He was very old, Yusuf said.
Mukhtar went to Hema to pay his respects. He found Malik's widow, named Warda, sitting in the upper story of her house. From the open windows, a cool breeze passed through the room. On the roof above, red cherries were drying. Mukhtar told Warda how sorry he was. Like her husband, she was very quiet, difficult to read. And like Malik, she was tiny, no more than 5 feet tall.
I will take care of you, Mukhtar said. He told her how much her and her husband's coffee meant to him and how he would always support her.
She didn't seem to have any idea what he was talking about. Mukhtar saw the scene through her eyes. Her husband of 50 years had died a few days earlier, and now an American, whom she'd never met, was promising to take care of her? Mukhtar met her son, Ahmed, and they talked about the future. Mukhtar was conflicted, though. His own business depended to some extent on the ability of Malik and Warda's farm to continue to produce the quality of coffee that had scored so high just a month ago. It seemed doubtful that the farm could continue without Malik.
The general wants to see you.
This was the message relayed to Mukhtar. He walked to the general's farm. From the start, the general had been the most suspicious of Mukhtar, given his Rupert clothing and city ways, but the sharpshooting contest had softened him to some extent. Now they sat, just the two of them, and chewed kat. Mukhtar showed him photos from Ethiopia, the red cherries and drying beds, and the general examined them closely. The general, kat, brightening his mood, talked about his time in the army and wanted to know how it was that Mukhtar had learned to shoot that well. Mukhtar told the truth, that he had learned in Bakersfield with Rakan and Rafik, and in Ibe with Amud. He mentioned that Rafik had been a cop in Oakland and had been the top marksman at the police academy. Somehow, over the next few weeks, this story evolved, traveling and expanding from the general throughout the village, until it was known that Mukhtar was the best marksman in California, having been trained by a special forces soldier. The general pledged his commitment to Mokhtar's work and promised to build the first drying bed in Hema. A few weeks later, he had done it. The Ethiopian's version had been welded from aluminum, but otherwise the general's drying bed looked identical. It was enormous and sturdy and would hold 10,000 cherries, the bulk of his harvest. He built it from local wood after simply looking at the picture on Mokhtar's phone. Hubeishi didn't call Mukhtar often. Usually it was Mukhtar calling him.
I have 20 tons for you, Hubeishi said. We picked them like you asked. Everything great.
Mukhtar was skeptical. Hubeishi was almost 80 and had been trading in low-quality commodity coffee for 50 years. Mukhtar had given him guidelines to meet specialty coffee standards, but he had no expectations that the old man would be able to get there, or that he would even try. Now he was saying he had 20 tons of specialty coffee. When Mukhtar arrived the next day, it was true. Hubeishi's staff had picked the cherries ruby red and had kept the lots separated. They had bagged and labeled the coffees as Mukhtar had instructed. There were 3 primary sources, the Huar Valley in Ib province, the village of Rawat in the Udain region, and coffee from Wadi al-Jannat, the Valley of Paradise. In all, 20 tons. This was far more than the Alamal Cooperative could possibly muster. If Ubeishi's coffee cupped well, and if Mukhtar had the money to actually buy it, he'd have enough specialty coffee, 18,000 kilograms, to fill a container. As Mukhtar traveled throughout the Ib Valley, his entourage grew. There was always Nuruddin, but now Yusuf from the Alamal Cooperative often came along, as did a rotating array of other farmers he'd already convinced to join his movement. And there was no one more committed than the general. He loved field trips to other farms, and his presence was particularly crucial in convincing other villages, other co-ops, to adopt Mukhtar's methods. One day, in a small village 100 miles from Hema, the entourage had taken a tour of the farms and had eaten lunch, and afterward, about 20 local men were relaxing and chewing kat. Mukhtar, perhaps too emboldened by the kat, was expounding about not just the ways the farmers could and should improve their cultivation methods, but how they were currently being exploited, enslaved even, by the loan sharks who operated in the region.
"They take advantage of you," he roared. "You're selling far too low. Sell to me instead, and you'll be free of these criminals. You'll be free, period. You won't be forever indebted to these sharks."
Mokhtar usually made it a point, whenever talking to an audience of farmers, to know the important players in the room, the head of the co-op, and which elders held sway. But this time, his intelligence was poor. The man sitting next to him, wearing a checkered keffiyeh and carrying a ragged mix of paper and cash in his vest, was himself a loan shark. The very loan shark who had all the local farmers under his thumb. He stood and turned to Mokhtar.
"How can you come in here and tell these people this nonsense?"
He narrowed his eyes at Mokhtar.
"You know, a man like you came here a few years ago. He was from Saudi Arabia and came promising the same kinds of things, and he didn't come to such a good ending."
Mokhtar registered the message. This man was threatening to kill him. He reached slowly for his Sig Sauer, hidden in his sarong. He had no intention of firing it, but thought he might need it to get out of the village alive. He couldn't gauge the mood of the room. Were they aligned with the shark, or with Mokhtar? Across the room, another man stood up. Mokhtar put on his glasses to see who it was. It was the general, his eyes enraged. He plucked one of the grenades from his jacket and raised it high over his head as he strode across the room, toward Mokhtar and toward the loan shark next. He put himself between Mokhtar and the man, the grenade almost touching the man's trembling face.
"If you interfere with Mokhtar," the general hissed, "you answer to me."
The loan shark smiled stiffly and sat down. Chapter 26. Money in your hand, not in your heart. Mokhtar was buying coffee, but had nowhere to process it. The only processing plant Mokhtar knew of was run by a man named Arafin Zafar. He met him months ago and knew his reputation. Zafar was Indonesian, and his Arabic was terrible. But he told his buyers in Asia and Europe that he was Yemeni. There were hundreds of thousands of immigrants in Yemen, and most of them had assimilated to some extent. But there was something about Zafar's way that bothered Mokhtar. And he processed his coffee in the same factory that made paper, a situation that prevented any of Zafar's coffee from being more than passable. There was no way to remove the vague smell of paper from the beans. But for now, Mokhtar had no choice. Abdul Al-Ghazali had told Mokhtar not to work with Andrew Nicholson, the only other man he knew with a mill in Sana'a. His reasons for shunning this Andrew Nicholson, who had appeared in Mokhtar's original SWAT chart, were vague. But Abdul Al-Ghazali was insistent. There would come a time when Mokhtar might have his own mill, but for the time being, he had to choose the lesser of two evils, and that was Zafar. Mokhtar went to Sana'a with samples of all three Hubeishi lots. At Zafar's plant, Mokhtar had to contend with Suha, who handled the day-to-day operations. Mokhtar gave her Hubeishi's samples and put in an order to have the samples hulled and sorted. Suha was always haughty and usually brusque, and as Mokhtar talked to her, he saw the sorters at their posts, about 20 women sitting at wooden tables, their beans in two piles in front of them. The sorters were silent, prohibited from listening to music, and he felt for them then and every time he visited in the next week, coming back three different times to find his samples unfinished. Suha provided excuses, but Mokhtar was running out of time. He needed the samples processed so he could roast and cup them and send samples to Willem, who was in Ethiopia. But Suha was dragging her feet, and one day, amid the 20 silent sorters, Mokhtar lost his temper.
"If you can't run this mill," he roared, "you should sell it to me."
Mokhtar had no idea why he said it. He had no money to buy a mill. But sometimes he put on the costume of the wealthy Yemeni American, knowing the people in a room like this wouldn't know if he was bluffing or not. The sorters looked up briefly before going back to work. But once Suha left the room, one of the sorters, an uncovered woman of about 30, approached him.
"If you're buying this mill, take me with you," she said in English.
Her eyes were steady. Mokhtar was startled. The presence of an English-speaking sorter at a coffee mill was unexpected in itself, but her boldness in speaking to him in front of the rest of the sorters was remarkable.
"I will," he said in English. "What's your name?"
"Amal,"
she said.
"Where can we talk?"
They arranged to meet the next day in a coffee shop. When they met, she told him of the wretched conditions at Zafar's mill. The hours were long, the pay was dismal, and it rarely arrived on time. They were not allowed to talk, to sing, to play music. One of the women had worked through the early stages of a pregnancy, and when she miscarried and fell ill, she was fired. Mokhtar thought of his grandmother in Richgrove, her many stories of the injustices visited upon farm workers in the Central Valley. His grandmother's sense of outrage was his own.
"If you set up your own processing plant," Amal said, "I'll follow you, and I'll get the rest of the women to come with me."
Over the next 2 days at Zafar's, the women finished sorting his samples, and in a rush, he packed them to be sent to Willem in Addis. He went to the DHL center in Sana'a and encountered the kind of add-ons he expected in Yemen. He had weighed his samples repeatedly and knew that he was sending Willem 3 samples, a total of 3 kilos. But the clerk at DHL said it was 4.2 kilos and wanted $100 extra for it.
"Please," Mokhtar said, "don't do this. I know it's 3 kilos.
The clerk weighed the package again, and again the digital readout said 4.2 kilos. Mokhtar checked to see if the clerk's hand was on the scale, but saw the man's hands at his side. Mokhtar had witnessed minor frauds like this dozens of times in Yemen, but this was impressive. Somehow, the clerk had rigged the scale, he figured. Mokhtar took the package off the scale and put it back. Again, the weight was 4.2 kilos. Now he was curious. He opened the box, and then opened all 3 bags. The first looked the same. The second was unchanged. But when he opened the third, he saw something shiny and black. It looked like a Sig Sauer handgun. His Sig Sauer handgun. In his rush to get the samples ready, Mokhtar had thrown his handgun in one of the bags and almost sent a loaded weapon to Ethiopia. Willem cupped the samples and found 2 of the 3 to be excellent. The Huwar Valley sample scored 88.75, and the sample from Udain scored 89.5. The Valley of Paradise sample was over-fermented, though, and was considered inferior. But it didn't matter. Because Hubeishi had followed Mokhtar's guidelines, now Hubeishi was sitting on 10 tons of high-quality beans from Huwar Valley and 7 tons from Udain. And Mokhtar knew he could buy it all. It would cost about $200,000 to buy all 18,000 kilograms of dried cherries, and with Willem's help, it would not be difficult to make a profit selling the container to specialty retailers in the U.S., Europe, and Japan. Hubeishi already had trucks and drivers and knew how to move coffee through the country. All Mokhtar had to do was pay for the beans, process, and sort them. But when he called his investors, certain they'd shared his enthusiasm for the high scores and the volume available to them, immediately, he added, they were unmoved. They were concerned about the security situation in the country, they said. Yemen seemed about to implode.
So?
Hubeishi asked Mokhtar. He was calling daily. Just waiting for the funds, Mokhtar lied.
Any day now.
Every morning, Mokhtar called and pleaded with his investors to actually invest in the startup he was there to start up, and every day, Hubeishi called, wanting to know if Mokhtar was going to pay for the coffee he had committed to buying. Hubeishi was gentle about it, but as the weeks went by, Mokhtar knew he would lose the coffee 1 ton at a time. Hubeishi had farmers and collectives to pay, so he sold 5 tons of the Udaini and then 5 tons of the Huwar Valley. Seeing the beans slip away drove Mokhtar to desperation. In a symbol of goodwill, Hubeishi gave him 5 tons of the Udaini. He accepted the $10,000 and the rest of the cost, almost $100,000, on credit. That was not a problem. Mokhtar was sure he would eventually get his investors to buy the coffee they had sent him to buy, but for the time being, there was the issue of where to put 5 tons of coffee. Mokhtar had no warehouse, and he had no mill. He didn't want to process his beans at Zafar's mill, given the working conditions, but the only other mill Mokhtar knew about in Sana'a was Rayan, the operation run by Andrew Nicholson. Nicholson had been the first American that Mokhtar had located in Yemeni coffee. Despite Abdu's warnings, Mokhtar had no choice. Ubeshi needed his beans moved, and Mokhtar needed a place to process them. Chapter 27 The Americans. When Mokhtar arrived at Andrew Nicholson's mill, his right-hand man, Ali Ahadri, shot a rifle in the air. The mood was celebratory. Mokhtar greeted Ali and Andrew, and inside, the atmosphere was a perfect inversion of what Mokhtar had been led to believe. The workers were content and friendly. The sorters were singing. Almost immediately, Mokhtar realized that Abdu al-Ghazali had wanted to keep Mokhtar and Andrew apart not because Andrew was an unscrupulous operator, but because he knew that Mokhtar and Andrew would get along and that together the two of them would be unstoppable. Andrew spoke Arabic with an accent specific to Sana'a. For a second, Mokhtar and Andrew couldn't decide which language, Yemeni Arabic or American English, they should use. They decided on English, and Mokhtar heard a drawl from the American Southeast. It was incongruous, even comical, coming from the mouth of a man in a sarong, with a Yemeni beard and a highly convincing Yemeni dagger tucked into his belt. He looked about as local as Mokhtar. But Andrew had grown up in rural Louisiana. He played baseball and married his high school girlfriend, Jennifer. He studied engineering in college and afterward went into sales. Successful, but restless. Andrew decided to go back to school to get into nursing. A few years later, while serving as a nurse at a Houston hospital, he worked with doctors and other professionals from the Muslim and Arabic-speaking worlds and became intrigued. This was after 9/11, and perhaps reacting against some of the bigotry he'd seen and heard as a child in Louisiana, he found himself drawn to his colleagues from Egypt and Jordan. If nothing else, he wanted them to know they were welcome. Soon, Andrew and Jennifer had decided to move to Yemen to study Arabic. They were in their 20s and more or less unencumbered. They didn't own a house, and though they just had their first child, she was 9 months old when they moved to Sana'a, it was an adventure they felt they could only do at that liberated stage of their lives. After 18 months in the capital, they had made friends and were fluent in Yemeni Arabic. They moved back to Houston, where Andrew became a consultant to companies operating in the Arab world. One of Andrew's friends, Sean Marshall, owned a cafe in Houston, and he introduced Andrew to Third Wave specialty coffee. One day, they were talking about coffee, its origins, and the state of the market, and Sean said, "What if you went back to Yemen and got some samples and maybe tried to export Yemeni coffee?" Andrew laughed it off, but in the morning, the notion seemed more plausible. Andrew and Jennifer talked it over, and 6 months later, they moved back to Sana'a. They stayed with friends at first, and every week, Andrew drove into the mountains to visit coffee farms and gather information. He returned to the capital with samples, but realized there was no one in Yemen who could properly process the cherries. He had no intention of starting his own processing mill, but without one, he had no business. So he worked with Sean and another partner to expand the scope of the operation. They'd work with farmers, bring beans to Sana'a, process them, and export them. They called the company Rayan. The scale of the investment was steep, and Rayan wasn't profitable in its first year or second. Andrew couldn't find reliable employees, but he brought in one good man, Ali Al-Hadri, who became deputy director of the mill. Everyone else Andrew hired stole from him. Andrew turned to Ali, and Ali turned to his mother. Ali's mother went back to her own village, 20 minutes from Sana'a, and put the word out. They were looking for reliable employees who wouldn't steal. In a few weeks, Ali's mother filled out the Rayan staff. She knew everyone working with her son, who was working with the American. They were covered. Rayan began operations during the Arab Spring in 2011, but the chaos on the streets did little to diminish the company's early success. People wanted Yemeni coffee, and Andrew found himself exporting to Japan, China, Europe, and North America. The upheavals in Yemen inconvenienced their work occasionally, but Rayan managed to operate continuously through the rise and fall of President Hadi and the arrival of the Houthis. It was all to be expected when running an export business from Sana'a. Mokhtar and Andrew agreed that they would work together, as partners and not competitors. Mokhtar would seek out high-end coffee in the hinterlands, while Andrew would stay closer to Sana'a and concentrate on exporting more affordable coffee. Rayan would process Mokhtar's beans, but Andrew couldn't do the sorting. He didn't have the space or the staff. The ground floor retail space of Muhammad and Kenza's building, that had until recently been a corner store where candy and soda were sold, was empty. Mokhtar thought it would make a convenient location, but Nuruddin was dubious. The location was convenient, sure, but there was the matter of the demon child who had been sighted there the last time the space was open. It had happened just a few months ago. In the middle of the day, a 13-year-old child had been found standing in front of the store with a knife in his hand, rolling his eyes and speaking in tongues. No one could reason with him, and finally, the consensus was that he was possessed by an evil spirit. The boy was taken to an exorcist in Sana'a, who deduced that there was indeed a demon inside him, and that this demon was in love with the child. Given the taint the devil had conferred upon it, the store was closed. Nuruddin related all this to Mokhtar. "We're talking about the store on the first floor, right?" Mokhtar clarified. He'd been inside 100 times. He used to buy his phone cards there. Mokhtar didn't believe that a demon had possessed the child, and certainly didn't believe that the storefront itself was tainted as a result. But the demon taint had left the storefront empty, and the rent affordable. So he leased the space.
"But don't tell the sorters," Nuruddin warned.
"Yemenis are superstitious, and even if one of the sorters was spooked by the story of the demon child inhabiting the storefront, it would be incentive enough for the rest of the sorters to stay at Zafar's demon-free mill." So Mokhtar told them nothing. He rented the space, and also rented the two adjoining storefronts, and knocked out the walls between. He created a lounge area with couches, a coffee table, and carpet. He doubled the pay for Amal and the other sorters, and one day in February of 2015, 16 sorters left Zafar's operation and arrived at Mokhtar's. Mokhtar made an event out of it. He had never employed anyone, but had picked up a few notions from the progressive California companies where his friends worked. He had in mind a kind of staff orientation day. He provided coffee and juice and cakes and gathered all 16 women together, asking them to sit in a circle. They all wore niqabs. He could see only their eyes. "I want to know about each and every one of you," he said, and saw in the women's eyes that this was highly unusual. "Let's go around the circle, and each of you can tell me your name, where you're from, and just as an icebreaker, you can tell me a food that represents you and why." The women had no clue what he meant. Why would they be a food? Why would an employer want to know such a thing? It took him 20 minutes to explain the concept. Finally, he got one of the women to suggest that if she were a food, she'd be a green apple. She was named Om Riyad, meaning Mother of Riyad. She was the oldest of the group, and Mokhtar could tell she was bolder, more outspoken than the others.
"Why a green apple?" Mokhtar asked.
"Green apples can be both sweet and sour," she said. "And I'm the same way. Sometimes I'm sweet, sometimes bitter. It depends on my mood."
The other women laughed, tentatively. "Good, good," Mokhtar said. But when it was the next woman's turn, she said the green apple represented her, too. The next woman said the same, that she, too, was a green apple. The women still didn't understand the concept and chose to copy one another rather than venture into the unknown. But he did get their names and hometowns, and he startled them all by knowing something about each of their origins. They expected him to be ignorant of the lesser-known regions of Yemen, but after visiting all 32 coffee-producing areas of the country, he knew the land as well as anyone. Aham said she came from Utma.
"I've been there," Mokhtar said. "Amazing guavas there."
Om Riyad said she came from Beni Ismail.
"I've been there," Mokhtar said. You have those little monkeys that roam around in packs.
Baghdad said she was from Hema.
Mokhtar asked her if she came from inner or outer Hema.
She seemed dubious that he would know anything about Hema. She said she was from outer Hema.
Al-Mahjal?
He asked.
Loa,
she said.
How about Beit Al? Beit Al-Zabadani?
He asked.
Almost there, she said.
Al-Asan?
He guessed.
Yes, she said.
The room broke open with cheers. Mokhtar unfolded his laptop and showed them pictures of his journeys across Yemen. They huddled close, disbelieving. They had no idea how diverse Yemen was, how beautiful. After a few hours, he had a sense of them, though he saw no more than their eyes. At Zafar's plant, the sorter's area was open to the larger factory, so the women there had to remain in niqabs all day, an uncomfortable and impractical state of affairs, given the labor of sorting and the lack of air conditioning. Mokhtar was determined to fix this. He couldn't operate a company in a busy Sana'a neighborhood with 16 women uncovered and visible to passers-by. The customs of Yemen frustrated him as much as anyone, but he couldn't risk the entire business to make a point about traditional clothing for Yemeni women. Compromise was necessary for now. He rearranged the space such that there was a large room with high walls and a door that closed and locked from the inside. The sorters could control who entered and when, and when they were alone, they could take off their niqabs and dress and act as they pleased. Mokhtar thought about the policies he'd wanted to change at the Infinity. He provided free breakfast and lunch, free Wi-Fi, transportation to and from work. He gave them May Day off and a sound system they could connect to their smartphones.
Do whatever you want to do while you work, he told them. You are my golden team.
He felt benevolent and thought that in their little space, they might approximate a Californian kind of operation, liberalized and egalitarian. But for the first few days, as he trained them, they were ill at ease. And though he'd provided the sound system, every time he walked by their workspace, he heard silence. He added a living room with couches and a prayer corner. Still nothing. A week in, though, he heard something. He was on his way to Rayyan when he heard a deep bass thumping coming from the sorting room. The women had closed their door and locked it from the inside, and Mokhtar stood by the door, feeling sure he recognized the song. It was Usher's Yeah. From then on, every day there was music coming from the sorting room. Sometimes it was traditional Yemeni music. Sometimes it was Katy Perry. In particular, they loved Roar. Often they sang along. You're in front of my face, he told them. He'd said it the first day, and he said it whenever they had a meeting, whenever he needed to remind them of their importance to him. In following him, they'd risked a great deal, and he would not forget it. You're in front of my face, he said, every day. It was an old Yemeni expression, hard to translate into English. It was something you said to a loved one, to a friend, while pointing to your own face. It meant that the person before you was never out of your vision, that you kept them foremost in your mind.
Book 4 Chapter 28 Bedlam.
It was December 31st, 2014, 3 days before the Prophet Muhammad's birthday. There were celebrations all over the country. Mokhtar woke up in his grandfather's house in Ibb with a plan to work out in the gym around the corner. But when he went downstairs for breakfast, he found his aunt staring at the television. A suicide bomber had struck Ibb. 49 people had been killed and 70 wounded. It was the first attack of its kind in Ibb, a city accustomed to being distant from this kind of violence.
It's begun, Mokhtar thought.
He had to be in Sana'a that day, so he left Ibb and drove north. When he arrived at Muhammad and Kenza's house, there were urgent discussions about the implications of a bombing of innocents in Ibb. Even Al-Qaeda wouldn't have perpetrated such an attack in Yemen. It typically directed its fury at Western targets, military targets, not Yemeni civilians. A week later, Mokhtar was back at Muhammad and Kenza's. One morning after breakfast, he decided to work out. The closest facility was called Health and Sports Club Arnold, named for Schwarzenegger. He took a taxi, and a few blocks from the gym, he noticed a crowd of men walking into the neighborhood. They were mostly Houthis. The gym, he realized, was close to the police station, and today was a recruiting day for the police academy. Part of the Houthis' plan was to stack their members in the police ranks. Mokhtar paid the driver and decided to walk the few blocks to Arnold's. He wanted to get a sense of what was happening, taking in the strange sight of so many northerners in the center of Sana'a. Then the earth convulsed. He fell to his knees. He thought it was an earthquake. He felt the concrete, expecting vibrations, aftershocks. He heard screams, the wail of car alarms. He ran toward the police station and saw the burning flesh. A man's torso lay on the ground. A woman was screaming. Blood stained the street. He scanned the charred remains of dozens of dead, thinking he saw people he knew. With a start, he remembered that Haytham, Muhammad and Kenza's second oldest son, was a cadet at the academy. Mokhtar knew he was home that day, that there was no way he would be among the dead. Yet he saw Haytham's face in the charred husks of men. Soon news people arrived. They began filming and taking pictures. Mokhtar put his phone away. He couldn't look at the carnage anymore. And then he had a thought. Run. He ran. He knew terrorists often set off a second bomb once rescuers had arrived to treat the wounded from the first. So Mokhtar ran, and everyone around him, thinking he'd seen something, ran too. At Muhammad and Kenza's house, he said nothing. Nuruddin knew something was wrong, but Mokhtar didn't want to burden the family with what he'd seen. They would see the footage on television. 38 had been killed. 60 had been wounded. Mokhtar didn't want his family to worry. Privately, he wondered what was happening in Yemen, and worried the country was going the way of Iraq, a lawless land of sectarian strife, suicide bombs, kidnappings, and the impossibility of untroubled life. Mokhtar went about his work as best he could. Every day he opened the processing mill for his sorters and provided breakfast, and they talked about the previous day's work and what needed to get done that day. He continued to train them, watching each of them, giving them notes. After lunch, he'd go to Andrew's mill to chew cot and talk business and politics. They didn't know if anything happening in Yemen would materially affect the country or their work. It seemed, at first, simply the usual transfers of power between equally incompetent players. On January 7th, two brothers, Sharif and Saeed Kouachi, entered the Paris offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and shot 11 people dead. On their way out, they shot and killed a policeman. A third man, Amadi Koulibaly, shot and killed a policeman in Montrouge, south of Paris. And four, at a kosher market. The attacks, precipitated by Charlie Hebdo's publishing of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad, brought forth a global outpouring of support for the magazine and its slain writers, editors, and cartoonists. On Sunday, January 11th, more than 4 million people throughout France marched in support of the victims and the right to free expression. On January 14th, the Yemeni branch of Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, claimed responsibility for the attack. On January 18th, the Houthis in Yemen rejected a new constitution drawn up by committee across the political spectrum. The next day, they seized the state television station. They took over all the government buildings in Sana'a, and President Hadi resigned in protest. Weeks later, he rescinded his resignation, but it didn't matter. The Houthis had control of the country. Mokhtar's family and friends in the United States worried for him, but Mokhtar saw very little change in his daily life. He'd gone to bed one night with Hadi in power and woke up without a president. And yet the airport was still open and hosted regular commercial flights. The banks functioned as usual. And the grocery stores, the health clubs, the mosques. Taxi drivers drove their taxis. Sana'a was still Sana'a, though it was now run by the Houthis. The lives of everyday working Yemenis continued unchanged. Mokhtar spent afternoons at Andrew's mill, chewing cot with Ali, and together they laughed at the Yemeni Americans who were fleeing the country.
We have no government now, Mokhtar said.
Wait, Yemen had a government? Andrew asked.
On February 10, 2015, the U.S. State Department announced that it was suspending embassy operations. The staff, it said, had been relocated out of Sana'a. The next day, the U.S. embassy was closed for good. The British embassy closed, too, and the U.S. and British governments urged their citizens to leave the country immediately. But there were no plans for a U.S. evacuation of American citizens. Commercial flights were still available, the State Department noted, and U.S. government-facilitated evacuations occur only when no safe commercial alternatives exist. The French Foreign Ministry closed a few days later. Given the recent political developments and for security reasons, their statement read, the embassy invites you to temporarily leave Yemen as soon as possible via commercial flights at your convenience. The embassy will temporarily be closed as of Friday, February 13, 2015, until further notice. It was not unusual for the Western embassies to close for a day or a week. The U.S. embassy had closed in 2001, 2008, and 2009. It was part of the rhythm of life in Yemen, Mokhtar assumed. The heat turned up, the embassies closed, and then, a few weeks later, with things calm again, they would reopen. Andrew was staying, too. They promised to keep each other informed of their plans. Until things became untenable, or, more specifically, until they couldn't continue their coffee work, they would remain. A few hours every day, Mokhtar tried to convince his investors to pay for the coffee he'd promised to buy from Hubeishi. It had been 2 months, and the investors were intractable. And as conditions worsened in Yemen, their hold on their money became even tighter. Mokhtar called Ghassan for advice. He called Willem, and Hubeishi called him daily. Where is my money? By March, most of the Yemeni Americans Mokhtar knew had left. He began to worry for Andrew. Mokhtar was part of a vast tribe and could count on their protection. But Andrew had no such heritage. In this new period, where standards and order were no longer reliable, any foreigner could become a target for kidnapping. Jennifer, Andrew's wife, would be safe if she stayed inside, but Andrew was known and would be sought out. On March 20th, suicide bombers detonated themselves inside two different mosques in Sana'a. Because it was during Friday prayers, the mosques, used by Houthi Shiites, were full. 137 men, women, and children were killed, and over 300 were wounded. This was the worst ever terrorist attack on Yemeni soil, and was claimed by ISIS. On March 21st, ISIS posted the names and addresses of all 100 American military personnel in Yemen and encouraged its acolytes to kill them. These last U.S. personnel were evacuated on March 25th, and the same day they left El Anad, just north of Aden, the Houthis quickly seized the strategic military base. The Houthis also took control of the Aden International Airport and Aden's central bank. Saudi Arabia, which had clashed with the Houthis in 2009 and 2010, now massed artillery and tanks near the Yemen-Saudi border. By late March, the Houthis controlled 9 of the 21 provinces of Yemen, including Taiz, the country's third largest city. It looks bad, Mokhtar said. He and Andrew were at the mill, chewing khat in the afternoon. It's Yemen, Andrew said. They were not yet committed to leave Yemen for good, but they were planning to leave temporarily to attend the Specialty Coffee Association of America, SCAA, conference in Seattle. Rayanne had rented a booth, and with hundreds of importers and buyers there from around the world, Mokhtar and Andrew considered the conference a crucial step in their work. Mokhtar would share Andrew's booth and present his Hema and Udaini coffees. The conference would be his most important event to date, his first real introduction of the progress he'd made with Yemeni varietals. Getting out of Yemen even during peacetime, even for American citizens, had become a fraught proposition. The stories started circulating in 2011. Yemeni Americans would go into the U.S. Embassy for some routine request and leave without a passport.
There had been bizarre interrogations, accusations of Yemeni Americans changing their names, living in the U.S. under false identities. Mokhtar had heard the stories. They were strange and unreal, none more so than that of Mossad Sheikh Omar. He was an acquaintance of Mokhtar's from San Francisco. A gentleman of about 60, he'd lived in the United States for over 40 years. In 1978, he'd become a naturalized U.S. citizen. He had a social security number, a California driver's license, paid his taxes faithfully. Like thousands of other immigrants, he'd left family members in his country of origin. In his case, one daughter had stayed behind with his own parents in Yemen. When she was 12, Mossad was ready to bring her to live with him in San Francisco. In 2012, he went back to Yemen to prepare the paperwork to get her a passport. In August of that year, at the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a, he submitted his application for a U.S. passport for his daughter. In December of 2012, he was summoned to the U.S. Embassy. They called him on the phone to say they had good news about his daughter's passport application. On January 23, 2013, he went to the embassy, thinking he'd be picking up his daughter's passport. When he got there, a consular official asked for his passport. Mossad handed it to the official, who asked him to sit in the waiting room. About an hour later, Mossad was escorted out of the waiting room. He followed an official through the main building and into an adjoining building. They walked through a number of secure doors, guarded by uniformed U.S. military personnel. Already he knew that this was likely a departure from anything standard. He knew he was not being led to his daughter's passport. He was taken into a small room where there were three men. One was an official with the Diplomatic Security Service, and another man served as an interpreter. The third man seemed to be an American, but he didn't speak throughout the process, which Mossad came to understand was an interrogation. Through the interpreter, the man from the Diplomatic Security Service asked Mossad questions about his origins, his family, his name. Mossad told him his name was Mossad Sheikh Omar. It was the name on his passport, after all, a passport granted and renewed by the State Department as recently as 2007. After an hour, Mossad was escorted out of the interrogation room and back to the waiting room he'd started in. He was told to remain there. An hour later, he was brought back through the secure doors and hallways, past the armed guards again, and back to the interrogation room. The man from the Diplomatic Security Service again asked Mossad about his name. Mossad again insisted his name was Mossad Sheikh Omar, the only name he'd ever had. The interpreter seemed frustrated with Mossad and began inserting his own advice into the dialogue. Beyond translating what the Diplomatic Security Service agent said, he began telling Mossad to cooperate, to tell the agent what he wanted to hear. This second session lasted another hour, at which point Mossad was again brought back to the general waiting room. He was told to wait there. Hours passed. Mossad hadn't had access to food or water since 6:30 that morning, difficult in normal circumstances, but in Mossad's case especially trying. He suffered from diabetes and high blood pressure, and while waiting, he felt faint and his vision blurred. He couldn't call family or friends, given cell phones were not permitted in the building, and the building had no payphones. At 4 p.m., Mossad was so desperate to be released that he approached a guard and told him that he needed to leave, that he would do anything to be allowed to go home and eat. The guard conveyed this to the embassy officials, and soon a consular official arrived and escorted him back to the interrogation room. There, he was given a piece of paper to sign. He was not a fluent reader of English, so he couldn't parse the paper's meaning. The interpreter was in the room, but didn't offer to translate it. Mossad was told to sign it if he wanted to leave the embassy. He signed the paper with his name, Mossad S. Omar, and the interpreter took his thumbprint. After he signed the statement, he was taken back to the waiting room and told to wait for the consul, who would return his passport. But his passport was not returned. Mossad was called to the window and told that his passport could not be returned because his name was not Mossad Sheikh Omar. At that, the official closed the window, left the room, and Mossad was escorted to the door by an armed guard. Mossad went home, and because he hadn't eaten or had water in 12 hours, he experienced a severe diabetic attack and was rushed to the hospital. As he was being treated, he struggled to understand what had happened at the embassy. He'd been given no explanation of how they'd come to think he was not actually Mossad Sheikh Omar. They provided no evidence. They offered no explanation and gave him no opportunity for redress. He wasn't given a date for a hearing or any idea of what he was supposed to do without a passport, while most of his family was in the United States and he had lived there for 40 years. The next day, he began calling the embassy, but the phone was never answered. He learned that email was the embassy's preferred method of communication, so he began writing emails. For the next 11 months, he wrote to the embassy, but received no response. Finally, in December of 2013, almost a year after his passport was confiscated on January 23rd, he received an email telling him to come to the embassy. He did so on December 15th, and when he arrived, he was given a written notice explaining that his passport had been revoked because an investigation revealed that you are not Mossad Sheikh Omar, born on February 1st, 1951. In fact, you are Yassin Muhammad Ali Al-Ghazali, born on February 1st, 1951. On January 23rd, 2013, you signed a sworn statement admitting that your true identity is Yassin Muhammad Ali Al-Ghazali. Because you made a false statement of material fact in your passport application, your passport is revoked pursuant to Section 51.62A2 of Title 22 of the U.S. Code of Federal Regulations. Mokhtar heard similar stories for years. Going to the U.S. Embassy for any kind of help, then, was not an option. On March 25th, just after the final American troops abandoned Yemen, and a day after Houthi forces advanced on Aden and forced President Hadi to flee by sea, Mokhtar directed a taxi to his local Yemeni travel agent, whose office was still open in Sana'a, to buy plane tickets to Seattle for a coffee conference. But when the driver got close to the travel office, Mokhtar saw a throng of Houthi mourners. It was the funeral for the victims of the March 20th attack. Soon, the crowd had spilled into the street, and the taxi was surrounded. Mokhtar knew he shouldn't be there. The funeral was a target. Terrorists had made a habit of bombing funeral gatherings to double their body count. Mokhtar got out of the taxi and pushed his way through the crowds. He'd get his ticket later. The next day, President Hadi made a direct appeal to Saudi Arabia, asking for its help in turning the tide on the Houthi movement. Citing the Houthis' ties to Iran, he pleaded for direct Saudi military involvement. Mokhtar heard about Hadi's appeal, but didn't think much of it. No one did. Mokhtar couldn't remember if the Saudis even had an army. Chapter 29 Mountains on Fire. At 3 a.m. on March 26th, Mokhtar was rattled awake. The building was shaking. He was at the Rayen Mill. He'd been working late and decided to sleep in Andrew's office. The rattle brought him to the roof, where he saw Fej Atan Mountain on fire. Houthi anti-aircraft fire striped the sky. Fires plumed around the city. It was the end of the world. Mokhtar went online and confirmed it was the Saudis. F-15s were bombing Houthi positions all around Sana'a. Every few minutes, there was another strike. The ceiling shook, and dust rained down. Mokhtar called his mother. "I'm okay," he said. She begged him to leave the capital and go to Ib, to Hamoud's house. Mokhtar thought it through. Ib was no doubt safer. The Saudis were unlikely to bomb Ib. But going anywhere in the middle of a bombing campaign seemed unwise. Mokhtar was in a high-density residential neighborhood of Sana'a, and from all the news he was getting, it seemed that the Saudis were after the Houthis' military positions and munitions dumps only. They wouldn't bomb a civilian neighborhood. He told his mother not to worry, and hung up. He tried to sleep. He counted the airstrikes. 50. 60. He lost track at 80. At 5 a.m., he heard the call to prayer. Then another. Competing calls echoed through the city. He went to the street, determined to wait out the last hour of darkness at the mosque. On his way, between the black silhouettes of the buildings, he saw the bright white stripes of anti-aircraft fire. Inside the mosque, a few dozen men were gathered as the bombing continued. The rug was gray with the ceiling's plaster. The imam performed a long supplication,
and the congregants prayed as if living their last minutes. There couldn't be so many military targets in Sana'a, Mokhtar thought. They must be hitting civilians, and this must really be war. When the imam asked God to forgive the sins of those present, the men around him wept, and Mokhtar knew he might die there, that at any moment a bomb would rip through the roof. Had it been a good life? Mokhtar thought. He wasn't sure. It was incomplete. He should have started all this coffee business sooner, he thought. Had he begun a year earlier, he would have at least done something, finished something, before the bombs rained down. Now he would die in a mosque. Maybe his family might find some comfort in that. Another bomb struck, now closer. The men around him stopped crying. They had submitted to their fate. Mokhtar did too. Nothing was within his control, so he lost all fear and worry. He felt a weight leave his shoulders. He would die. He would not die. It had nothing to do with him. He could run from the mosque and die. He could stay in the mosque and die. He could go to Kenza and Muhammad's home and die among his family. He could go to Rayyan and die with his coffee. Or maybe he wouldn't die. He and the congregants stayed an hour until finally the quiet between bombs spread and became whole. At daybreak, it was over. When Mokhtar and the rest of the men left the mosque, the sun had begun to rise, and the city was bathed in an eerie pink light, the air bright with dust. Mokhtar, feeling a new and encompassing peace, walked from the mosque to the mill, sure that nothing would ever frighten him again. It was as if he had died already. Later that morning, he went back to the travel agent. He told her he wanted 2 tickets out of Sana'a. He and Andrew had to get to the SCAA conference.
What are you talking about? The travel agent said. There's no airport.
The Saudis had destroyed runways and threatened to shoot down any plane leaving Sana'a. Mokhtar went to the mill. He and Andrew chewed khat.
It was closed during the Arab Spring, too,
Andrew said.
It'll reopen.
Mokhtar checked the U.S. State Department website, expecting to find information about an organized evacuation for American citizens. There was nothing of the kind. Every day, the State Department offered vague indications that Yemeni Americans should find passage out of the country by any means available. There was recent precedent for the U.S. State Department helping its own citizens evacuate from a foreign country at war. In 2006, the Pentagon and State Department helped 15,000 Americans leave Lebanon during the war between Israel and Hezbollah. But this was different. Given the presence of AQAP and ISIS, the U.S. decided it could not risk a large evacuation. They had no embassy or staff on the ground, thus had no effective way of screening all the prospective passengers on a plane or ship. They deemed the prospect of unintentionally bringing a terrorist into the United States too great a risk. They decided to leave American citizens stuck in Yemen to their own devices. An official notice from the U.S. State Department said that there are no plans for a U.S. government-coordinated evacuation of U.S. citizens at this time. We encourage all U.S. citizens to shelter in a secure location until they are able to depart safely. U.S. citizens wishing to depart should do so via commercial transportation options when they become available. This led to the creation of a website, StuckInYemen.com, which documented the plight of those remaining in Yemen. The site was supported by the American Muslim advocacy groups, including the Council on American Islamic Relations and the Asian Law Caucus. The site grew to include a registry of 700 Americans hoping their government would provide a way out of Yemen. Under pressure from Arab American civil rights groups, another State Department spokesman, Jeff Rathke, explained that those Americans remaining in Yemen had made their own bed and now they must lie in it. Because they had ignored long-standing warnings from the American government, he implied, this was on them. For more than 15 years, the State Department has been advising U.S. citizens to defer travel to Yemen, and we've been advising those U.S. citizens who are in Yemen to depart, he said. At another State Department press conference, another spokesperson, Marie Harf, referred vaguely to escape opportunities for Americans. One reporter asked her for clarity.
What are those opportunities? He asked.
Swim?
Mokhtar needed to get out, immediately. He had to make it to the SCAA conference in Seattle, and he had to escape the escalating violence, in that order. Every day, he checked with the travel agent to see if any flights were leaving. But the airport was